KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, we update you on the wildfires that have hit Big Sur and are continuing to rage there, and we'll find out from residents about the effects of the fires on that unique community. We'll also explore some of Big Sur's history and culture and find out what makes it so unique a place and a community with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the program. Big Sur has been hit hard by fires, and the fires unfortunately continue to burn. We want to update you on the fires and the effects they're having on the residents as, well, the fires continue to threaten the community, which for the first time in its history is under a mandatory imposed evacuation with its main road closed, although that has been lifted. We'll find out more about that in the course of this hour. We also want in this hour to explore the history of Big Sur, which derives its name from El Sur Grande, Spanish for the Big South, a name bestowed by early settlers in Monterey, who looked to their south and saw a huge unexplored area with a coastline treacherous to ships. Today, Big Sur is often an area without official boundaries, but it's usually seen as stretching about 89 miles along Coastal Highway 1 between the San Francisco Bay Area and Los Angeles, its north end at Carmel and its south at San Simeon. Highway 1 officially opened through the Big Sur region in 1937. Known for its beautiful coastal scenery and its towering redwoods, its mystique and its identification with creativity and spirituality, Big Sur, which was a hippie mecca in the 60s, has been linked through the years to famous residents such as actors Orson Welles and Rita Hayworth and author Henry Miller, as well as to the Hearst Castle, Esalen Institute, Tassajara Hot Springs, Jack Kerouac's novel Big Sur, and the movie The Sandpiper. In this forum hour, we want to not only focus on the recent fires, but talk about the history of a unique and distinctive community, a region of incomparable natural beauty. And before I welcome our panel, I want to welcome Paul Van Gerwen, who is battalion chief with Cal Fire, who is right at the Basin Fire as we speak. And good morning to you.
Good morning.
Glad to have you with us, Chief. I wanted to just find out, first of all, if you could give us a sense overall. I know 80,000 acres, we're talking about 18% contained. How do things look from your perspective at this point?
Well, we've made some real good progress, certainly along the Highway 1 corridor. We still do have some mopping up to do along the way. However, things are going well, and we're hoping we can get things mopped up before the warmer temperatures come in and set in the area.
Well, the hot temperatures are coming, and in fact, there are red flag warnings through Thursday, are there not?
That's correct. And because of those higher temperatures, up to triple digits, as well as a very low single-digit humidity is predicted, that obviously is going to increase some fire activity, and we're going to be watching that closely.
People are going to be going back today?
In some areas, that's correct.
And what about the dangers?
Well, in those areas that they've gone back, again, we've had the ability to put in the containment lines as well as fire out. So those areas that they've been allowed to return, the threat has been minimized.
You've also been able to cordon off homes and businesses?
I'm sorry, repeat that?
You've also been able to cordon off homes and businesses in Big Sur and in Goleta?
In the Big Sur area, those evacuations that are still in place, correct, but those that have been lifted, they're still monitoring the entry for residents only.
Talking to Battalion Chief Paul Van Gerwen, who is at the Basin Fire in Big Sur, there's a whole concern about exhaustion and the firefighters, the difficulty, the physical strain and so forth. I know there are fewer firefighters and there's a mandatory rest period coming up. Can you give us your sense of that?
Yes, as you know, we've entered into very early fire season here in California this year. A lot of fire activity. Of course, the lightning series that came through, we still do have numerous active fires throughout California. So the resources we have, they've been working several days, long hours, and it starts to wear, and so we're trying to be conscientious of the health and well-being of our personnel and give them the rest periods as we can and as that period comes available. It is going to be warm. It's going to be tough. However, I think everyone's starting to get in the mindset that this is going to be a long fire season, and we're going to have to do what we can to pace ourselves and keep our personnel healthy.
You got a lot of heat stress injuries, though.
I believe we've had some, but exact numbers, we've been taking all the precautions to avoid that with the hydration and the rest cycles, and that's always a concern every year. Of course, that'll be an increased concern over the course of the next few days as those temperatures rise and those type of illnesses can occur.
Well, good luck to you and the crew, and thank you so much for joining us this morning, and keep it going.
Thank you very much.
That's Paul Van Gerwen, who is Battalion Chief with Cal Fire. We have assembled a number of people to talk with us about, well, not only reactions to the fire, but also Big Sur, as I said in my introduction. And with us by phone this morning is Kirk Gaffel, who is General Manager in Nepenthe. Also heads the Big Sur Chamber of Commerce. He's the third-generation owner of Nepenthe and joins us by phone. Welcome, Kirk Gaffel.
Hi, Mike.
Good morning to you. We also want to say good morning to Sula Nichols, who is an artist who lives in Big Sur. Her house burned in the wildfire, and we'll talk to her about that. Welcome, Sula Nichols.
Thank you.
And Gordon Wheeler is also with us, who's president and CEO of ESLIN, the ESLIN Institute, which was founded in 1962 as an alternative educational center devoted to the exploration of what Aldous Huxley called human potential. And Gordon Wheeler, full disclosure, is a friend. Glad to have you with us, Gordon. Good morning.
Good to be with you, Michael.
We also joined this morning, we will be joined by a couple of other people that we'll bring into the conversation, but I wanted actually to go to Sula Nichols first, who has obviously suffered a great deal, lost a home in this wildfire. Actually, there were two homes on your property, were there not?
That's correct, yeah. The main house and the guest house.
And you live over on Partington Ridge, which is a permanent community and really like a village, and there's a sense really of, from everything I'm reading and hearing, that people have really come together in this crisis.
Definitely. Because my house burnt down very early in this fire, I actually did exit quite early. But initially, we scrambled together and got the trailers, took out the animals, friends further down south to put us all up. We did want to stay and protect our homes, and we had trouble with that. But that's another story. But yes, we really are a tight-knit little community up on Partington, and we help each other out in times of crisis.
Well, let me extend sympathy to you over the loss of your home. I know that must be a terrible loss, but what I've been really dazzled by, frankly, is your attitude. I mean, you're an artist, and you feel these are only material possessions, and you're ready to move on and rebuild.
I am. Yeah, I really am, and it's surprising. I'm surprising myself with it, but... you know, you do the work as you grow older. You work on yourself, and Big Sur is an amazing place for that. And you do learn that, you know, the land remains, and the things that we put on the land come and go. And I'm looking forward to rebuilding. And, yeah, I mean, what else is there to do but look, you know, be positive? I think, you know, you can be sad. I think sadness will percolate up as time goes by, and I realize what I've actually lost, because I did lose pretty much everything. And... but it's an opportunity, and that's how I see it.
Well, I wish you the best of luck, and I'm, again, as I say, dazzled by your attitude. Now all you have to do is show a way to fight those rebuilding permit processes that you have to go through.
Yes, this is something that I'm, you know, obviously girding myself for, and I'm hoping that they will help, you know, they will be helpful and cooperative. I really do.
Best of luck to you, and appreciate very much you joining us. And I just need to ask, Sula, actually, that's the name of a Toni Morrison novel. That's your name.
That's my name, yeah.
An unusual name.
Yeah, it's actually short for Chris Sula, which is a Greek name, but I like to be referred to as the Toni Morrison Sula, yes.
Well, I thank you again for joining us, and I wish you the best of luck. We're also joined, as I said, by Kirk Gaffel, who is the general manager of Nepenthe, a famous place of many people, of course, who have traveled to Big Sur know. And... let's talk first about what you've had to go through in all this, Kirk. I mean, the highway's been closed, and to some extent, even though you feel you've had, through the years, good relations with law enforcement, you haven't been terribly happy about the way things have been exercised. Huh?
Yes. I mean, and first of all, let me say that any inconvenience or deprivation we've had is absolutely nothing compared to what people like Sula and the families have lost their homes and what the Partington Ridge community and some other enclaves have gone through. Their loss is really immeasurable, and in many respects, we've had a huge inconvenience, and I think, which is important to put into perspective, but and really which was manifested more than anything by the law enforcement aspect of what became known as a mandatory closure. Early on in this event, when the fire started to affect the community and the highway was initially closed, which is a common practice, be it from mudslides or fires or car accidents and various other, you know, situations that cause immediate safety to a particular locale on the highway, closing the highway to the public is a tried and true and perfectly reasonable and make, you know, kind of approach. What became very unique, though, was that following that, there was the use of a mandatory evacuation order at different junctures. And that then was interpreted and used to not only effort getting people off their property, but also to restrict and prevent local traffic within a closure zone. And historically, the road has been closed many times for great distances in large zones and zones that encompassed multiple properties. And in the entire history of since the highway opened in 1937, there has never been an instance where the civil authorities have used, number one, a mandatory evacuation, and number two, where they prohibited the use of the highway so that neighbors could attend to their needs of their others that and receive the assistance of their neighbors. They could not attend to property needs that many properties straddle Highway 1 on the east and the west, or they have water systems that are on one side of the highway relative to the other. And it was one thing for us not to be able to drive our vehicles on the road for the first time ever in an event which, for the most part, in localized areas was no more severe than many events we've had in the past and less severe in many instances. But then on July 3, the order was expanded to prevent access to the highway right-of-way, by which we interpreted and have never been disabused of this notion, that prohibited the use of pedestrian access, so that if you set foot on the highway right-of-way, much less the highway itself, you'd be subject to detention and removal from the evacuation zone.
You see, the road was closed for, 16, 17 days?
That's right. Yeah. At different junctures and at different points, it's been an evolving thing. But up until 10 a.m. this morning, it's been an ever-expanding zone. There was a slight contraction to the south. Right now, it's closed in a mandatory manner from Lucia down, which is about 20 miles south of Nepenthe, to approximately 20 miles north of Nepenthe, to Palo Colorado Canyon, though at 10 a.m. this morning, the mandatory evacuation zone is going to be removed from the west side of Highway 1 from Julia Pfeiffer Burns State Park, which is about 8 miles south of Nepenthe, north to Palo Colorado Canyon. So the southern third of the fire zone, about 12 miles between Julia Pfeiffer Burns and Lucia, is still in this mandatory evacuation and lockdown, and it's created an enormous hardship on residents. It's completely counter to the culture and the history of this community of assisting our both being self-reliant and helping each other out, and it's been administered in a manner that has been extraordinarily problematic and confrontational. In a community that has had extraordinarily positive relationships with law enforcement over many decades, and in a short matter of 14 to 17 days, we've seen it become an adversarial one for really unnecessary and unclear reasons.
Again, Kirk Geffel is manager, general manager in the Nepenthe, and also head of Big Sur's Chamber of Commerce. Also had an economic effect, we should add, of course, because well, people can't work, and the tourist season has been affected to a great extent. I want to bring my friend Gordon Wheeler into this discussion. Again, he's president and CEO of Esalen, and let's talk at least first about the economics a little bit with you, Gordon, because I believe Esalen's the second biggest employer in Big Sur.
Yeah, that's our understanding. Depends a little bit how you count. And we are, of course, hurting sharply economically because, like many other we're a nonprofit, but it's the same for the profit businesses farther to the north. Our costs are mostly fixed and go on, while the income drops to zero. And particularly in our case, where we're carrying all of our staff wherever they are at full salary. If they can't do anything for Esalen, we're paying them to work in any shelter or other nonprofit in their area where they've taken refuge.
You've lost a million now?
Well, yeah, if you count up by weeks, about 250,000 a week is our gross intake. And since we're a nonprofit, we run it about even. That's about the same as our losses.
Well, between the Rat Creek fire back in 85 and El Nino in 98, it's like a little bit like Job here as far as Big Sur. And yet the place retains its magic and the people there retain their optimism. And in fact, you've described it as not just a place, but a state of mind.
Indeed it is, and this is a challenging environment in every way. That's what people value about Big Sur. These things will go on happening. Thank God this time there's been no loss of life so far. That's the way we want to keep it, tragic losses of homes. But as Sula says, the land remains, and it will regenerate, and people will come here because they have a deeper experience in this challenging environment. That's part of the package.
Some of that magic and the spirituality that's associated with the area can perhaps be, well, exhibited by Esalen itself, which is a land that goes back to Native Americans.
Yes, and the Native Americans, the Esalen Indians that lived here, we have middens on the property going back 6,000 years when the mineral baths were in use here by the Indians. Those Indians had controlled, planned burns of the forest at regular intervals. They understood this as part of the cycle of nature. Of course, they didn't build permanent homes in the forest, so that's where the problem comes.
And there has been, I understand, from those great vegetable gardens at Esalen, food provided to the firefighters?
Well, yeah, and many neighbors, too, and we've also sent it. You know, we're still under mandatory down here, but when we can get, even today when our visiting doctor is here bringing down medications from town, we'll send him back with a trunk full of vegetables for the Meals on Wheels up in town, because our gardens are in full swing and we don't have the 350 eaters here every day. There are just 52 of us hanging on. So we've got a great excess of great vegetables. I wish we could send some up to you.
Gordon Wheeler, again, is president and CEO of the Esalen Institute, which was founded in 1962 by Michael Murphy and George Leonard. And we've got Stephen Harper on the phone. He's a wilderness guide, a naturalist, a psychologist. In fact, has taught eco-psychology at Esalen. And Stephen, tell us, first of all, good to have you here. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you, Michael.
Actually, you built your home down there, didn't you?
I did.
And what's the status of your home and you?
Well, I'm on the west side of Highway 1, which is the side that has not burned. I have Highway 1 and the fire between me. I was under mandatory evacuation and chose to stay here. Did that very mindfully. I've lived here 30 years and been very involved in most of the fires in some manner, either on the front lines or helping map the fires. Back earlier, I did studies in fire ecology and fire behavior, so I feel like I'm at least knowledgeable in the choices I'm making to stay here and have good, clear evacuation routes should the fire change, because the truth is a fire, given all the right conditions, it's going to have its way, and we can have all these human ideas about what we're going to do about it, but all the right conditions or wrong conditions, and we're just going to be a little thing in its way.
Well, you're also going to have to deal with mudslides on Highway 1.
This year we'll have mudslides, and a lot of that depends upon how the rains come. In 1972, after a really small fire, the way the rains came, real heavy for a very short period of time, created mud flows that flowed down and actually buried part of the Big Sur post office and parts of the Big Sur Valley in mud.
We've been hearing, you know, about the crisis there and how it's affected the community. Sula Nichols talking about how the community came together, has come together, and Kirk Geffel talking about how law enforcement has created problems in terms of community interconnectedness. Talk a little bit, if you will, about what's been going on from your perspective. I know there's been a lot. There's been night watches and phone tree and internet and things that suggest that the community really has come together.
The community has, and that's one thing Big Sur does well. The more kind of difficult the challenge, the more the community comes together during a crisis of some kind, and it's happened again. I've seen that through many, many times. And in our neighborhood, we put together a phone tree of watches all along that extended quite a long ways from Post Ranch to different ranches all the way down to all the exit points where we had eyes on the ground of people that chose to stay here. We could stay in contact by phone and had night watches, like you said. Lisa Gettle put up a wonderful website. We weren't getting information as timely and specific and accurate as we wanted, so she put up a website where we could specific people could blog into it and get very up-to-date information much faster than we could get it from the government agencies. And it allowed, all those tools kind of allowed us to feel a bit safer here and make our choices based on that information. And a lot of sharing of food. In a way, it's a very surreal experience because on one hand, there is this crisis. And again, I did not lose a home, and I can only, my heart goes out to those folks that did. You know, but there's this surreal kind of quality of appreciating the fragility of life, but also seeing how life kind of finds a way around everything. There's incredible resilience here in the community. In the mountains here, the plants will have that same resiliency. And I think that's one of the things that we love about this place.
You know, there's lots to love, and it's the only place with California condors thriving in the wild where there's a coastline. And Stephen Harper, thank you so much for joining us. Stephen Harper, again, is a wilderness guide, naturalist, and psychologist who lives in Big Sur. And Magnus Torin also lives in Big Sur. He's executive director of the Henry Miller Library, joining us here. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
I've just been talking about this extraordinary history that Big Sur has and its magic and all of the natural wonders there and so forth. Henry Miller is kind of, well, absolutely identified with Big Sur, isn't he?
Yeah, he is, at least in this area. I think there are still people who kind of discover that Henry Miller is associated with Big Sur when they get there. But no, you're right, he's... When he came, I guess people sometimes the locals kind of resented him coming because at the time he was more famous than Big Sur, and he brought attention to Big Sur back in 1944 that some people back then and I guess throughout time has always wanted Big Sur to be their own domain.
Well, now you've got the library there, which draws Henry Miller fans and people who discover that he is indeed a part of the whole history, huh?
Right, right.
What does the library have?
The library is a stop alongside the road there. It's in a beautiful little redwood grove right adjacent to the highway. And we have, for the casual visitor, what we have is a display of artifacts and art and artwork from both Miller and some of the other artists that have lived in Big Sur. They have a sort of an eclectic bookstore, information about Big Sur, and mostly the artistic and cultural heritage of the area. We have lots of events at the little library, and then sort of behind the scenes, we also have a very significant archives of primary source material pertaining to Henry and the artistic and cultural history of the area.
And you've been free from the fires so far.
Oh, the battle for the library was sort of an epic one, early days of the fire, where the people at Nepenthe, which is a restaurant just north of the library, could sit with a front row seat and watch the helicopters going tandem up and down to the ocean and essentially save the library on the back porch.
Well, we appreciate very much your being with us this morning, and we wish you good luck and ongoing success with the library. Magnus Torin, again, is executive director of the Henry Miller Library. And we're going to continue this discussion. We're focusing not only on the fires of Big Sur, but talking about its culture, its history. I know there are many of you who have a love for the place, for the setting, know about the history, may want to join this conversation, may have questions about the ongoing struggles with the fire. If you would like to join us, you can do that now, toll free. It's 866-733-6786. Lines are open and available to you, and we welcome your phone calls. Again, 866-733-6786, or send us an email to forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Wildfires are continuing to threaten Big Sur, and we're talking about not only those fires, but looking at the rich history and culture of that coastal community and talking with residents about the impact the fire has had on the community. We spoke earlier with Paul Van Gerwen, the battalion chief with Cal Fire. We also spoke with Sula Nichols, a resident and artist who lives in Big Sur, whose house burned in the wildfire. And we spoke with Stephen Harper, a wilderness guide, a naturalist and psychologist who lives in Big Sur, and Magnus Torin, the executive director of the Henry Miller Library. And with us for the rest of the hour, Gordon Wheeler, who's president and CEO of the Esalen Institute, founded back in 1962. And we're also talking to Kirk Gaffel, the general manager of Nepenthe, which is in Big Sur. He's also head of the Big Sur Chamber of Commerce. And we're going to have you come into the conversation. I know there are many of you, as I said, who have been to Big Sur, who have fallen in love with the area, and who have some thoughts and reflections about it, as well as concerns about the fires that are ongoing. And if you would like to join us, you can do so toll-free with our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786, and that'll work whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. You can also send an email, and our email address is simply forum@kqed.org. And before I begin taking calls and emails, I just want to go back to, well, Kirk Gaffel for a moment to talk about a little bit from your sensibility, the magic of Big Sur in terms of its history. I know the early settlers were pretty hardy stock of miners and ranchers and manufacturers, but it's gone, mountaineers, excuse me, but it's gone through a lot of changes, and certainly with the hippie, I don't know what you call it, influx, I guess, and more recently a Hispanic influx of workers and whatnot. But the big change, I guess, took place in 1937 when Highway 1 opened, didn't it?
Yes, I mean, in my view, Big Sur, if you were looking at the last 100, 150 years, the most dramatic, significant change was allowing casual or easy ingress and egress through the entire stretch of the coast. You had to be a pretty determined person, know how to ride a horse or be a very fit hiker or, you know, brave a schooner to come down the coast to get anywhere to different points, either from the interior or from the northern or southern reaches up until the highway was built. And then from 1937, it utterly changed the opportunities and the access. And while the physical beauty of the highway is pretty remarkable unto itself, and I think in many ways complements that of the coast, it did afford people the opportunity to come in who never before would have even considered visiting, much less building a home or potentially a business, and really allowed the whole world to discover Big Sur in a way that would have been impossible before the existence of the highway.
But, Gordon Wheeler, there are still outhouses in Big Sur. There's no municipal water system. You've got your own septic system. I mean, things are in some ways very different than they are up here.
Very different. Our big news right here on the campus at Esalen this morning is that overnight we saved our water tanks. Fire came up to about 3 feet from them. They had gelled. They had sprinkled. Our crews were up there working till late in the evening, and it seems to have worked. So that's what you deal with down here.
You were also off the generator during the fires, weren't you?
We lost our main generator, but Brian Scott, an incredibly resourceful electrician here, has got it up and running again, and we have backups. Every system we have is pretty well failed, but they patch it back together and keep us going just using the materials that are here on property because we're still under the mandatory.
Well, let's hope that that's lifted soon and that the fires are put out. And let me go to our callers, and we have Timothy first from Carmel. Good morning, Timothy.
Good morning. I just wanted to say hi to Gordon and Kurt, and thank you for your work forever on this thing. And I'm one of the grandchildren of one of the early people who came there in the 50s, a man named Giles Healy. And I just wanted to share with your listeners something that I ran into Little Bear, Tommy Nason, last night, who is one of the elders in the Esalen tribe, and he had a wonderful thing to say. He said, you know, fire is spirit, and spirit has a wonderful way of working, and I don't want to in any way demean people's losses because they're horrific. When I first heard about the fire, one of our next-door neighbors' houses was gone, and it was devastating to me, and it's devastating to a lot of people who know that property. But Tommy said that, Little Bear said that the Ventana has been saged, that spirit is allowing spirit to come in and also allowing the spirits to get out. And I thought that was a wonderful metaphor in terms of the possibility for new life and the regeneration and for the whole community as a whole. And in the midst of this terrible loss and this disruption of the economic ability of people who live there, hopefully that metaphor could serve some useful purpose in terms of how we look forward and deal with our losses.
Well, we thank you for those sentiments and appreciate you calling us. We'll simply move on to more of your calls and go to Shira next. Good morning, Shira.
Good morning. I was wondering if anyone knows the status of the artist Emil Norman's house, because it's a very special place filled with art, sculpture, built-in organ. And I'm not even sure if he's alive, but if he is, he's a very old man. This would be quite traumatic for him.
Kirk Gaffo, can you fill us in?
Yes, Emil is still very much alive, and his property, his home, his studio, and all of his artwork that was left in Big Sur, assuming they did not remove it to out of the area, would be intact. His home and studio is located on the west side of Highway 1, and for everyone who has some kind of familiarity with Big Sur, which essentially runs north to south, the entirety of this fire experience has been on the east side of Highway 1. So all residences, properties of any kind on the west side of Highway 1 have been physically unscathed by the fire, except for, you know, the being recipients of some dust and ash.
Again, Kirk Effel is the general manager of the Penthe restaurant in Big Sur and also head of the Big Sur Chamber of Commerce. And I thank Shira for her call. You know, one of the things I think that is extraordinary about the area that we're talking about here, Kirk, is the fact that this beauty has been preserved. There's been little development, and what development we've seen has been kind of out of public view. And it's not been overrun by tourists either, despite the fact that there have been so many.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there was a lot of foresight very early on. Even when my grandparents built Nepenthe in 1949, 12 years after the highway was opened, my grandfather's first thought was, let's build a hamburger shack on the side of the highway. And the entire community went up in arms. I mean, they just said, are you crazy? This is you. That's the worst possible thing that could happen. And that was purely from an aesthetic point of view. And my grandmother, you know, said, wait a minute, you know, we can do something very special here. And with a group of artisans and artists that were associated with them, you know, out of that came the design through Rowan Maiden's work of building Nepenthe in a way that really integrated into the landscape. And our neighbors really had, and we certainly developed very early on through that experience, such an appreciation for the values, the aesthetic values, and the natural values of the community. And that ultimately culminated through many efforts into the coastal protections that exist to this day. Some of them are a little intrusive, but for the most part, they've been very successful in maintaining the real physical beauty and natural integrity of the coastline. And to the extent that development has expanded, you know, over the last 40 or 50 years, it's largely been out of the public view shed. So wherever the public really has access, primarily along the Highway 1 corridor, they're not seeing homes or businesses while walking along the road or driving. And in fact, the most common question we get at Nepenthe is, well, where do you live? Where does everybody live? Because people drive through this beautiful, majestic environment, and they see so few homes, they can't imagine how is it possible that we're dining with, you know, dozens or perhaps hundreds of people, and we see all of the staff, you know, caring for us, and where did they come from? Where do they go? So Big Sur really becomes, as Gordon was saying, and I think Henry Miller said it originally, and who knows where it came from before Henry, Big Sur really is a state of mind and more than a physical place.
It's also, Gordon Wheeler, a place that really needs to be seen and also felt because of the climate. I mean, it's a moderate climate, and it's a climate that really holds up and sustains just like the land.
It's a wonderful climate, and at the same time, the environment confronts you. It does. They say legendarily Big Sur selects its own in terms of residents. It's not for everybody to live down here. Those who do love it fiercely. But for the people who come for a shorter stay, they come because their experience is deeper here. They're thinking, they're feeling. That's what Esalen's all about. The people report this over and over and over. They step into Big Sur and they step into a different state.
And they sometimes stay down there and find themselves living a very different kind of life, cut off in many respects from all this urban stuff up here.
Very remote, and people, interestingly, in Big Sur, people that lived in cushy, suburban, urban, or ritzy environment and setting in the city will accept conditions down here that are quite different.
Let me go to more of our callers. John, thanks for waiting. You're on with us. Good morning.
Yes. I had a very
informative experience in Big Sur when I was growing up in high school, and I'm not sure exactly when it was, in the late 50s, early 60s, we went camping there, and we had the experience of seeing these huge semi-trucks with a single log as wide as the road lane going through there every few minutes all day long, and it was just heart-rending. So that really sort of disturbed me. I don't know where the trucks came from, but they were using that road right along there in Big Sur.
And yet, as we heard from Kirk Ganfell, there's been surprisingly little development through the years. I mean, in terms of when you're thinking about big logging and all that.
Well, active logging in the community ceased pretty much at the end of the 19th century, and that really wasn't even a function of regulations or environmental concerns. It was that the accessibility to most of the canyons where the first growth redwoods existed, that was very difficult to access to get that. So our kind of remote quality was a great protection in that regard. But there were local mills that milled redwood that was more accessible. And the description that your caller just described is that's the first I have, frankly, have ever heard of that kind of description of logging trucks going through here. But, you know, from experience, if you hike through the canyons, you'll certainly see some evidence of logging, but it's pretty easy to see because it's close to the highway or close to a drainage that had relatively easy access to the ocean so that they could actually remove the wood, because for the most part, it's a very difficult coast to, even with the modern-day construction techniques and bulldozers and helicopters, to even build a simple dwelling, much less do a large-scale logging operation.
And let me go to a couple of emails here. Nani writes, I just want to put out there a great big thank you to all who stayed behind in Big Sur and have worked so hard to save their properties, as well as work with administration to get the road open. Also want to put a word in there for the people on the ground on the other side, not only the evacuees, who for the most part manage the upheaval with grace, but the volunteers at the hotline, Red Cross, and many in the community who have come to help and offer donations. And here's Eric, who writes, don't forget the photographers of Big Sur, Morley Bear, Wynn Bullock, the Weston Dynasty, Edward, his sons Brett and Cole, Cole's son Kim, to name just a few. Let's go to more of your calls. Ann joining us from Martinez. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning. 30 years ago, my family and I, with about 25 other people, camped near the Pfeiffer State Beach during the fire 30 years ago. We were there for 2 weeks. Practically couldn't go anywhere, but, you know, we had a wonderful time, but it was a bizarre experience, and I wondered, what's the difference in the two fires?
I can speak to that.
Kirk,
why. The Marble Cone Fire, which your caller is referring to, was an enormous fire. It was the largest fire in modern history in Big Sur, but it was in the wilderness area. It was feared that the fire would spill over the top of the Coast Ridge and threaten homes in the Big Sur Valley, but it never did. This fire breached the Coast Ridge Road and the fire lines and did, in fact, and initially started on the western slopes of the ridge and moved into the wilderness as opposed to originating in the wilderness. And so this is a duality. This fire has both a large wilderness component and more of a developed business residential interface along the coast, and that's what has made this fire unique in scope and scale.
Gordon Willer, one of our listeners said that I may have unwittingly given some wrong information here. I mentioned that the founders of Esalen Institute were Michael Murphy and George Leonard, and the listener says no, Richard Price.
That's correct, Michael. George Leonard is often referred to as our third founder because of the decades of central contribution he's made to our thought development. But Dick Price and Mike Murphy, a couple of graduate school dropouts from Stanford and Harvard, founded Big Sur here on Michael's grandmother's property, founded Esalen Institute on Michael's grandmother's property in 1962.
And if I remember, I think Michael's father Steinbeck's doctor?
Michael's grandfather delivered John Steinbeck, their neighbors in Salinas, and the families were close friends.
And let me just, we still have Magnus Torren with us, who's the executive director of the Henry Miller Library, and Magnus, some thoughts about what has drawn all these artists and all these creative people, including Henry Miller, to Big Sur?
I think
I think Miller probably speaks to that best in his book that he wrote about his experiences in Big Sur, called Big Sur and the Oranges of Hieronymus Bosch, where he describes how he, when he first came down in 1944, immediately fell in love with the, in his case, you know, with the isolation, the grandeur of the landscape. He called it his Easter Island in America and his paradise, and it was isolated. He fell in love with the neighborhood. So the social aspect, interestingly, I think, was part of it. He just really enjoyed the help that he'd received from his neighbors, and he was a representative of someone who had grown up in Brooklyn and lived 10 years in Paris, and he had never really done any practical work in his whole life. And here he ends up on a ridge in a small little house, having to deal with the daily chores of life. And he embraced that fully, and his neighbors came over and helped him when he needed it. And I think some of those aspects of that isolation and that self-reliance and simply the beauty of the landscape, of course, have touched people throughout the years.
That self-reliance and rugged individualism that we often associate with Big Sur, Kirk Gaffel, is something that you see as instrumental in being kind of a magnet for so many artists and creative people, no?
I think it's a real draw, and as Gordon said earlier, Big Sur is very self-selecting. People arrive with all sorts of ambitions and desires to be here, and their first winter in most cases usually disabuses them of that notion because it is so inconvenient and such a struggle, and they don't realize just how much they've taken for granted, about how much easier life can be elsewhere, and whatever rewards they were seeking for are outweighed by the challenges. On the other hand, people come here with no expectation whatsoever, and perhaps even complete ignorance of anything about Big Sur. They're just driving along the highway and find themselves on this coastal route, or somebody invites them to take a jaunt, and they set foot onto one of these properties. They see the coast, and their lives are transformed, and in many cases, they've never left.
Well, Gordon Wheeler, Kirk and his family have been there for generations. You came out of Texas and lived in Massachusetts and certainly fell in love with a wonderful woman, Nancy Lunny, who has been involved with Esalen for years as program director and so forth. But what draws you to the place? What keeps you there?
Well, it's in the end, you know, I can say certainly it's the mission of Esalen, this combination of personal transformation and social transformation and commitment that we think is our unique vision. But what really holds me here the most is the community. The community at Esalen and in Big Sur, it's the people. You just, it's something that you have to experience to really feel. But I think the people that come to Esalen to take a course and visit here, they do feel the presence of a living community, which is hard to find these days. It's sure. Really something unique.
Gordon Wheeler, again, is president and CEO of Esalen Institute. And let's bring Roger into the discussion here. Good morning, Roger.
Yes, good morning. I have some experience down there. I've always enjoyed it. But there's one area that I'm particularly interested in, and that's the Benedictine Monastery. It's on the east side of the highway. I hope that survived. And also Tazahara, I hope that survived.
What do we know at this point about those places, Kirk Gaffel?
The new Grimaldi Hermitage, so far as I know, was not threatened in any immediate sense, and I'm all but certain it suffered no losses given its southerly location. It's just south of Lucia, and in fact is now would be considered in the voluntary, or actually it's completely out of the entire evacuation zone. So that property is certainly safe. The Tassajara Zen Monastery is, to my knowledge, at this point still untouched by the fire, but is very certainly threatened by the continuing fire. It's possible the containment lines have been fully established around the Zen Center, but I would say that the Zen Center is still very much under the threat of the current fire conditions.
Well, another listener, Liz, wants to know if you know about the Dejan's Inn and whether it's okay just down the road from the Henry Miller Library in Nepenthe.
Yes, Deachin's is still very much alive and very vital, and they're just waiting to get back in and to tend to the needs. Principally, the damage to Deachin's was to its water system. It came very close to Deachin's, as it did, as Magnus indicated, to the Henry Miller Library, where both those properties are in the bottoms of very steep canyons, directly adjacent to Highway 1, and the fire encroached right onto their back porches, their backyards, and, you know, just the extraordinary effort of the on-site residents and employees and the firefighters was what saved those properties, and that has just meant so much. Nepenthe, we get calls from all over the world asking, if not about us, about Deachin's and or about the two properties. And it's interesting how the linkage has been so connected for so many people over the years. And even people who have never been here who have gotten wind of this story are sending us their prayers. And it's just been the most comforting part of this experience, in addition to just seeing the strength of our neighbors around us.
Kirk Effel, again, is general manager of Nepenthe Restaurant and head of Big Sur Chamber of Commerce, third-generation owner of Nepenthe. Gordon Wheeler, here's a Discord note. Listener calls Esalen a rich person's playground and says, letting this guy advertise the Esalen Institute, you might as well tell what it costs to stay there. It's basically a hotel complex for the elite, unlike the friendly spiritual sanctuary the spokesperson would have you believe. And that's signed Faye, who loves Big Sur but lives in the city.
Well, Faye, we do struggle with keeping our prices down, but we also have programs for 70 interns, people of all age, young people, but people of all ages from all over the world that come here at extremely low cost for a month, or they're paid to come here for a year. So that's one way to come. We also have scholarship programs for all kinds of groups. We do a lot of pro bono work. Permaculture groups come in for free. I certainly acknowledge the problem you're talking about. Half our people come and say, how do you keep it so cheap? And the others say, geez, it's getting out of reach. It's a challenge for us.
You should also mention, though, that Esalen Institute was a place where a lot of preparatory work on Glasnost took place. There are ongoing dialogues going on there now with members of the Islamic faith, are there not?
Indeed, we're working with our Russian friends out of those days where Esalen tried to play a role in the peaceful devolution of the Cold War. We're working with the Russians to reach out to Muslim communities around the world. It's Esalen that brought former President Khatami, the moderate Muslim from Iran, to speak at the National Cathedral last year, the highest-ranking Iranian official to come since the Carter years, since the hostage crisis. So we are doing what we can to keep up that rich tradition.
And we'll move to more calls. Tom, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hey, great show, Mike. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, the discussion has been such a high spiritual and artistic level. I hate to bring up nuts and bolts issues like the Bixby Creek Bridge. I remember back in the last fire, I guess it was in the 80s, the firefighters were marching over the bridge bumper to bumper, hauling huge bulldozers, D-10s, whatever they were. And one of the Caltrans, whoever was there, or firefighters had to go out in the middle of the bridge and say halt because the bridge was vibrating like a roller coaster. I was wondering, what is the status now of the bridge? Is it going to be repaired, replaced, strengthened, or what, for firefighting and maybe national defense or sometime in the future?
Yeah, what can you tell us, Kirk Effel, about Bixby Bridge?
Well, a couple things. One, I think a lot was learned in that fire experience about the care that those bridges need the people need to have for those bridges. And in 1998, following El Nino, they did massive retrofitting with remarkable care for the aesthetic details of the historic bridges in Big Sur. And while I don't know specifics about how they've managed the bulldozer and the heavy equipment access across the bridge, Bixby in particular, in this fire, I do know that they learned a lot from that previous event, and I'm sure that they adjusted the weight loads and ensured that they didn't have multiple vehicles on the bridges at the same time. That was a well-understood and appreciated concern that came out of the last event, and I have not heard any indications that that's been a problem or the need for any repair to any of the bridges as a result of the fire traffic.
Kirk, let me ask you if you know about something else which one of our listeners wants to know about, and I know many other listeners are probably concerned about, and that is how the wildlife have been affected and whether there's been any signs of distress or what kind of regeneration of land will be required.
Well, one thing that's been very good about this fire, although probably for the wildlife side, though it's been really a strain on the human aspect of it, is it's been a very slow fire. We have not had significant wind events throughout the duration of this fire, except from very localized areas. It has been a ground fire. It has not burned the trees for the most part, except for dead trees. The redwood forest that the fire was burning under, it just swept underneath and took out deadfall and grasses. And in a sense, that was a very healthy fire, except for where it interfaced with the developed properties where people, you know, lost their homes. And it's moved slowly. And as a result, it has not, I think it's afforded, you know, the adaptive species that are used to fire, you know, by virtue of, you know, that they've evolved in this community, you know, not just this community, but in this whole Western United States landscape, they certainly have had plenty of time to move around. Now, I don't want to diminish the biological and habitat changes, and I'm not an expert there, but it's not as though this thing was a firestorm. It has not denuded the landscape. It's not a moonscape by any means. In fact, it's remarkable as you look around and you see the mosaic of unburnt vegetation surrounded by burnt grasses and green trees and the magnificent redwood forest that is still very much intact, particularly on the coastal zone. Now, at the upper reaches of the Coast Ridge Road where it burned hotter and in the wilderness area, I'm not as sure what the impact was there. But I do know that the Forest Service from the very first day comes in with an assessment, reforestation, revegetation program where biologists are very site-sensitive to the fire, even while it's being fought.
Well, we're going to continue to follow this story. Obviously, I wish all of you good luck in preserving and sustaining the beauty and certainly extinguishing the fires. One listener puts it best here by email. David says, good luck fighting the fire spirits on the brink of the world to all of you. And thanks to all of you. Thanks to Kirk Gaffill from Nepenthe, Gordon Wheeler from Esalen. We also spoke with Paul Van Gerwen, the battalion chief, and Stephen Harper, Sula Nichols, and Magnus Torin. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.